Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. Today we are going to be considering confirmations for the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board, as well as a bill by Senator Skoy. What I thought we might do is have a overview of the, or at least some explanation of the Environmental Quality Board, because we haven't dealt as much with the board over the last couple years. I understand there's some staff here from the board. Maybe if you could approach, introduce yourselves, and tell us what the Environmental Quality Board does and give us some highlights of your activities of recent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Wells. I'm the staff director of the Environmental Quality Board. Our executive director retired 2 weeks ago, so he is in Florida having fun right now. The Environmental Quality Board is, and I didn't know I was going to be doing this, so I'm just going to wing it, if you will permit that.
That'd be fine.
The Environmental Quality Board is an interagency and citizen board. It's really fairly unique across the country. We have nine commissioners of the key state departments that either manage part of the environmental package or are representing an agency that affects the environment, like transportation or economic development or commerce. So we have energy and environmental commissioners on our board, as well as five citizens, all of whom are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. At the present time, we have four citizens. We have a vacancy on one of those citizen slots. The Environmental Quality Board is basically responsible for looking at environmental issues that cut across agency department lines and seeing where there are gaps and seeing where there are overlaps that that need to be coordinated. There are a number of key authorities. Section Chapter 116C04 is our main is the main location of our authorities, although we have water authorities in Chapter 103A and Chapter 103B that are a very important part of the package as well. And also Chapter 116D, the Environmental Policy Act, is something that, in a sense, the Environmental Quality Board is the overseer of. And Greg Downing, to my right, is staff of the Coordinator for Environmental Review Issues and knows more about the Environmental Review Program than anybody in the state, which is, and I can say that with full confidence, he's been doing it for 25 years or so at the Environmental Quality Board.
116D covers which topic?
That's the Environmental Policy Act, and where environmental review is described.
Okay.
As well as some environmental policy directives that most state agencies tend to forget about, frankly. But it's something, if you go back and look at it, it was adopted in 1973, and it's a remarkable piece of law. And it's something that we need to revisit, I think, and take account of more than we have tended to do. It brings in energy issues, land use issues, transportation issues, power plant issues, and so forth, and suggests here's broad legislative policies that everybody ought to be following in those arenas. So it's quite a remarkable law. The Environmental Quality Board develops the state rule, that the overarching rule for environmental review, and Greg is the expert on that. If you have questions about that, I will defer quickly to Greg on that. My background is I've come from the water arena, and kind of a double background. For years, I've worked in water policy issues through our 103A and 103B sections of law that direct EQB to look at, to take the pulse of how we're doing on managing water in the state and to recommend changes to what we do and to recommend priorities. We are responsible for doing the state water plan, and we're responsible for doing biennial water assessments with our partner agencies, the DNR, the Pollution Control Agency, and the Department of Agriculture, are three named ones. Other agencies, of course, are on the board that it would be very important in that whole process as well. The Health Commissioner, for example, in the Health Department is, to name another one, as well as, I think I mentioned, agriculture. So our job is to take the pulse of how we're doing on water resources, to tell you every 2 years what we think that pulse is saying to us, both in a priority-setting way and a policy way, and to take that every 10 years to do the state water plan. So the next state water plan is due in September of 2010, not too far off. We're just now starting to think about, okay, what do we want this water plan to be? We've had two different kinds of state water plans. The one I led in 1990 was a policy-oriented plan saying, you know, we ought to have policies such as If we're going to be giving money to a soil and water conservation district or a local government for erosion control, maybe they ought to have a erosion control regulation to complement that. That one has not been adopted, but that was kind of a radical policy that we proposed. Another example was, if we're going to do county geologic atlases, we ought to digitize the data. In 1990, we were not doing that. Well, we now do that automatically so that data is portable and more easily assessed. That's the kind of plan we had in 1990. In the year 2000, our plan was, well, let's start putting milestones for water. Let's define milestones for water so we can actually measure our progress on the ground, kind of a more practical approach, on the ground for how our management system is working. Are we getting the results in the water on the land that we need to be getting to protect Minnesota's water resources? And so we defined a whole series, river basin by river basin, a whole series of indicators for seeing whether our progress was adequate or not. That's the 2000 water plan. So we have to decide, and maybe a mix of those two approaches is something that I'm thinking we maybe ought to argue for, but that's what we'll have facing us in the next 2 years as we work on the 2010 water plan. Until the year 2005, the Environmental Quality Board was responsible for siting energy facilities. That was transferred by the legislature in 2005 to the Public Utilities Commission, and the staff is in the Department of Commerce. So we no longer have that responsibility at the Environmental Quality Board. Am I missing anything big as far as the broad functions? I will say the EQB in Section 116C04 has the responsibility to consider environmental initiatives of its member agencies to see whether or not they're all fitting as part of a team package. I guess there is one other thing in that vein of making sure things fit together. That is a key EQB role, is making sure that the left hand of government knows what the right hand is doing. And we could certainly do a better job of that than we have been doing, but that is a main function of the Environmental Quality Board. In Section 116D, 10 and 11 is a fascinating charge to the board that was adopted in the early 90s to do an energy and environment strategy every 2 years for the governor and the legislature. We've never done that. We have a subcommittee now that's saying, you know what? There's nothing more important that we could do than to do that. And if John Bloomberg, actually, the citizen member who's here today that you are going to be asked to confirm, has been a leader in that whole subcommittee conversation, so you can ask him his perspective about it. But the feeling of the subcommittee, which includes John as the one citizen member, the chairman of the board, Gene Hugeson, Commissioner Brad Moore, and Commissioner Dan McElroy, their feeling is that if there's anything EQB did besides its main water and its main environmental review functions, it should be to make sure that what we're doing on energy and the environment all fits together. And it's not to displace the leading role that the Office of Energy Security would have. It's just to see, how does this fit with DNR? How does this fit with PCA, with agricultural initiatives? Biofuels covers all those things. How does this fit with transportation policy? How does this fit with land use policy? How are we going to get the global climate change gas emission reductions that we have in mind if we don't change how state agencies approach these things? That's a kind of an ideal recommendation of our subcommittee. It's still not anything we're doing yet. We put it on the table for people to think about internally at the Environmental Quality Board. We haven't gone public with it. The governor's office is still considering the initiative. But that's another thing that EQB has in current law that I just want to bring to your attention. We have a few other things. We manage a program called the Critical Areas Act. The only critical area in the state right now is the Mississippi critical area through the 7-county metropolitan area. The Environmental Quality Board is the overseer of that act. So if there were another need for a critical area around the state, like to protect Lake Mille Lacs or the North Shore or whatever, the Environmental Quality Board would be responsible for doing the analysis of what the issue is, what's at risk, why can't existing institutions solve that problem, and why do we need to have a new getting together of those existing institutions to address a critical need. So we could do that, and it doesn't have to just be environmental. There's a cultural element too. If small town Minnesota is going to go away in one valley or something, and you know, historic sites are going to be trampled by a road or whatever. We could do the work to define a critical area. The normal designation only lasts 3 years unless the Regional Development Commission, or for the metro area, the Met Council, adopts the critical area and requests that it become permanent. And that's what's happened in the seven-county metro area. Some people think for better or for worse, but that's the reason that's an ongoing critical area program for the seven-county metro area. But that's another package of authority that the Environmental Quality Board has. We also have the authority to regulate genetically engineered organisms, and we share that with the Department of Agriculture for those things that are coming out of the agricultural sector. But we're the overarching body for that regulatory function, and we have a state rule that we adopted years ago, I think mid-90s, to deal with that issue.
Could you give me an example of how you regulate GMOs, for example, or anything else? How do you regulate them?
You know, frankly, Mr. Chairman, the rule provides for the Environmental Quality Board to intervene, and I don't know how we do that. And so I can't answer your question. I can certainly get back to you on that. For everything that's happened to date has been an agricultural issue, and shortly after that rule was adopted, the legislature adopted an amendment to the law saying for things relating to agriculture, the Commissioner of Agriculture is responsible, and they now have their own parallel track with us on that. So they have actively addressed that concern for agricultural issues like genetically engineered crops, for example. And they now do that. That's active. We have not done anything else and have not had to. We thought we might on genetically engineered fish for a while, but that kind of went away. But the action has been in the agricultural community under the Commissioner of Agriculture, which is why I don't know exactly what our procedures are, and I apologize for that.
Is there an area that the EQB is active in intervening?
Not for genetically engineered organisms.
In any topic?
Oh, yes. We're very active in environmental review. In fact, we have environmental review changes that are awaiting the governor's office approval to be released for public hearing, which will address more precisely activities in shoreland zones, environmental review for activities in shoreland zones, for activities for area urban-wide review, if I got that right, for cumulative environmental effects. We've always had a hard time describing and thinking about how to deal with cumulative environmental effects in a reasonably bounded way. Our proposed rule actually is quite innovative and thoughtful and provides a new approach, thanks in part to the state Supreme Court's ruling that affected that issue. So on the environmental review rulemaking, we were very active, and on the waterfront, we're very active. We adopted last spring
Wells, could you try and be more specific about when you say review or you're active or you regulate? I'm struggling to find specific examples of what the EQB actually does. So if you could be a little bit more specific, for example, regarding shoreland rules, could you state specifically what the EQB did or is doing?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. And for that, I'd like to defer to Greg. And when he's done, I want to come back and I'll give you some specifics about our water exercise.
Okay.
But let's do the environmental review one first.
Okay. I don't mean to interrupt your presentation.
That's fine.
I just, if you have more, please continue.
Well, let's do Greg first, and then we can come back to me if that's okay.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Downing. I'm the environmental review coordinator for the EQB staff. With respect to environmental review, the most important responsibility of the Environmental Quality Board is to adopt and amend the rules under which the program operates. And those rules are binding on all state agencies and political subdivisions. And almost all the reviews are done by other agencies than the Environmental Quality Board. Many years ago, the Environmental Quality Board actually did all the environmental review, but for the last 25 years, it's been essentially totally decentralized to local units and other state agencies. And the basic rule of thumb is the unit of government with the most responsibility for a development project is the what we call the responsible governmental unit that carries out the review according to the procedures in the the Environmental Quality Board rules. And a large degree of the staff time of the board is spent helping those units of government understand how to apply those rules in particular cases.
So if we're talking about an environmental assessment worksheet, is that done by a company, for example, a mining company, and they create a worksheet and they do it according to rules that have been established by the EQB?
Mr. Chair, that's basically correct.
Okay.
For any given project, the project may require mandatory preparation of an environmental assessment worksheet. Some big projects require mandatory preparation of EISs, but only the very biggest projects. Most projects don't require review at all, but it can be ordered on a discretionary basis by some unit of government with approval authority, and that's often initiated by what we call the citizen petition process. We receive about maybe 50 citizen petitions a year that go to whoever the EQB staff determines is the appropriate responsible governmental unit, and that unit can order an EAW if they feel that the facts of the case merit that.
So environmental review means an EAW, an EIS, and anything else? And is it just plain agency staff review of the project?
Mr. Chair, when we use the term environmental review, we mean the preparation of an environmental assessment worksheet, environmental impact statement, or other substitute document. There are a few other kinds of documents that have been approved by the Environmental Quality Board under the authorities given in the Environmental Policy Act to do so to other processes that can be used instead of the standard EAW-EIS process. There aren't very many of those, but the most common one is what we call the alternative urban area-wide review process, which is sort of a hybrid of the EIS and EAW processes that a local unit of government with an appropriate comprehensive plan can use to review future development in a certain geographic area, irrespective of having applications for projects within that area. This can only apply to residential and commercial light industrial type development.
Senator Sharon.
When you're talking about the rules being established by the EQB and then the local unit of government is the entity, I guess, that takes that information and does the analysis and determines whether or not further review is or if the information is adequately provided or what the outcome of that is, if it's an EAW. When you're saying local unit of government, are you meaning the county? Are you talking about the city? Are you talking about and do you determine who the local unit of government is based on a certain capacity or expertise to understand and do a proper analysis of that data?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the local unit of government could be the county, the city, or in some cases townships, occasionally watershed districts. The one that's chosen for a particular project is normally the one that has the greatest authority over the project, which usually means the one that has the zoning-type authority over the project. Sometimes there are questions about whether it should be, say, a township or a county, and in those cases, the EQB staff will discuss the matter with the officials from those units of government and try to help them decide which one would be most appropriate, and if they can agree that it should be the township instead of the county or vice versa, that's the one that will carry it out then.
Follow-up question.
Sharon.
And is there ever a question once that is local authority is designated, if at least my experience is working in the rural part of the state that sometimes around the Mankato area, some of the smaller communities don't have the professional staff capacity to carry out certain functions. Is there a place that they can go and get a consultant? Do they hire someone, or how do they create the expertise to take that information and analyze it in a way that meets the objectives of the environmental review?
Mr. Downing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that's a very good question. There are many units of government that are called upon to be the responsible governmental unit for a project occasionally that don't have very many staff and don't have very much expertise. There are several ways in which they can get assistance. Just for basic information about how to proceed, they can talk to our office. We can help them with that. But in terms of, you know, acquiring expertise they may need, they most likely would have to hire a consultant of some sort to help them with that. In the case, if they're doing an environmental impact statement, the law requires the proposer of the project to pay for the complete costs, which would include staff costs, of whoever is the RGU. For EAW's environmental assessment worksheets, the law doesn't say anything about costs except that the proposer has to supply data necessary. If a small local unit of government has to do an EAW and they don't have the expertise, most of them, one way or another, in their other ordinances or other procedures, have ways they can charge fees or otherwise collect money back from the proposer so that their costs can be reimbursed. And units of government that have experience with environmental review frequently adopt specific ordinances that authorize them to recover their costs or charge fees for that.
Okay.
Thank you.
So the EQB is responsible for all the rules for worksheets and impact statements that we debate here from time to time, whether it's an ethanol plant or an energy plant. Senator Sharon's bill, Senator Berglund's bill, all those things that we debated whether an EIS is necessary or whether a project is not subject to review. Those are all standards. Those were all created by standards set by the EQB. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Yes, the Environmental Policy Act specifically directs the EQB to adopt what we call mandatory categories for projects that require EAWs and EISs and assign the responsible governmental unit to those. And okay. Most reviews are done because of those mandatory categories.
Okay.
The other common reason is due to a citizen petition that results in the responsible governmental unit deciding that the project does merit an EAW, even though it's not mandatory.
Okay. How many projects, if any, does the EQB actually do or be responsible for the worksheet and EIS a year, for example?
Mr. Chair, it was your question that the EQB itself would be the responsible governmental
yeah.
unit for? At the present time, we would only be responsible for things that would rarely occur. Up until the time that the energy facility program was transferred to the Public Utilities Commission, the board did probably several dozen environmental assessment worksheets or EISs or the equivalents for energy projects per year.
Okay. I don't know what the name of the project was. The plant in Minneapolis, Senator Berglund's bill.
Midtown Eco Energy.
Yeah, Midtown Eco Energy. We heard from the PCA on that primarily. But you're saying that, why wasn't that with the PUC, like you're saying, since this is an energy project?
Mr. Chair, that project was an unusual case. When the energy facility programs were transferred to the Public Utilities Commission, there were a very few authorities that did not actually get transferred and technically still reside with the Environmental Quality Board. And the Midtown Eco Energy Project happened to be one of those types of projects. So there was the problem with it being done by the EQB is we no longer have any staff that have any expertise in energy facilities. And in that particular case, we talked to the staffs of the Department of Commerce, who does the work for the Public Utilities Commission for environmental review, and the staff of PCA, and it was decided that the Pollution Control Agency staff was in the best position to be the RGU for the Midtown Eco Energy Project, and that's the way it turned out.
I see. Okay. Okay.
Is there any, are there delineations of projects that necessarily have to go to a responsible government unit? For example, you said that there's energy projects generally go to the PCA. Are there other categories that generally go to one agency or another?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Our mandatory category list in the rules that specify what projects need EAWs and which need EISs, for each one of those categories, there is a designation of the appropriate RGU. So many times it is simply local governmental unit, and then it needs to be determined which local unit has jurisdiction. But for all the what you might call industrial-type projects, one or another of the state agencies, usually the Pollution Control Agency, sometimes the Department of Natural Resources, would be specifically designated as the RGU for that type of project.
What percentage of the EQB's activities constitute the environmental review rulemaking versus what I'm kind of sensing is a discussion forum type activity, kind of coordinating issues and such?
I could jump in again, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the number of staff, we have two environmental review, two mostly water, but everything else. That's it. We had a fifth one who was our director who now has retired, and the current governor's budget proposal is to freeze that position out as a cost savings. So, and I think that's probably a fair way of describing the relative workload loads, although as far as board exposure is concerned. So right now we're at a point in time where we are either frankly going to go up or down. This is not a sustainable level, so that's a decision that people are going to have to make. There's a great amount of things that let me mention a couple of things that we've done in the past to give you an idea of the potential of the board. If there were not a board of water, if there were not an environmental quality board, there would not be a board of water and soil resources. That was a recommendation of the environmental quality board in the early 80s. I did the study, special study on local water management that led to the state's Comprehensive Local Water Management Act, the one that has counties doing water planning. That wouldn't probably exist. We certainly were the initiating agency to do that, to recommend that to the legislature. And it was a battle because people thought, hey, county governments, they're just drainage entities. We don't want to deal with them. And we had to fight to say, yes, but the way to get them to be more broad thinking is to give them responsibility for comprehensive local water management. That happened in 1985. We managed the first grant program before the Board of Water and Soil Resources came into existence with LCMR money at the time in 1987. We led the development of the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989. So we've had some pretty profound influences on the environmental package of institutions that you deal with every day. In fact, proposed legislation to create the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which was a battle because we were abolishing three existing boards by doing that. It was a whole series of nasty conversations over about 5 years before that actually became law. And now they're a healthy, active organization doing their own thing, and they're a member of our board. So there have been some very important, I think, profound involvements of the Environmental Quality Board. More recently, I wanted to mention last year adopted this report, Use of Minnesota's Renewable Water Resources, Moving Towards Sustainability. We have a state that has a great water appropriation permit program, but we have not ever we haven't compared supply and demand on an area or a regional basis to know how we're doing. And this was the first time that this has been done on a county scale. It's led to another charge at the request of the Pollution Control Agency growing out of the concern with ethanol production facilities. And we now have the Environmental Quality Board has adopted a work plan, and I did send that to Ms. Heck for a water, we're now calling it a water availability project, to look at how we could define a broad framework to put site-specific decisions into perspective with. You can make decisions point by point by point by point and still not know where that's taking you. And that's a concern of the Pollution Control Agency Board, and that is a new assignment that we're working on at the Environmental Quality Board at the present time. One other thing I forgot to mention, and it's really near and dear to me, Through the 1990s, we actually led the state's Sustainable Development Initiative. We actually initiated it, and we got Governor Carlson to buy into it to actually start people thinking about how environmental and economic issues needed to not just always be butting heads, but to be working in an integrated fashion. And a friend of mine coins it this way: it's going to become increasingly harder to protect the environment if the economy says not to. We need to actually get back to thinking about sustainable development, and that was a major initiative of the Environmental Quality Board in the 1990s. And it led to a series of recommendations, some of which were adopted in law, not enough of which were adopted in law. And that initiative was undertaken by the Environmental Quality Board under our broad authorities to look at how issues cut across agency department lines. So.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wells, I detect a tone of exasperation in your voice. What is the difference between then and now? You talked about all of these great accomplishments back in the day, and now you're talking about some major initiatives, some major direction you've received, and it sounds to me like you're trying to communicate to us that you may not have the capacity to do that. Did you have greater capacity back when you made these great accomplishments, setting up the board of Bowser and the like?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble,
Mr. Wells. We
had a water planning staff of 7 people at that time. Now we have 1.5 to 2, depending on whether you divide me up into everything else.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a difference. We had it's kind of a strange thing, but we had a state planning agency back then, in which EQB was housed in. Now we're housed in the Department of Administration, which is great for staff support, but not so much moral support, if I can use that term loosely. But so we had an agency looking forward to the future, which was much of the function of EQB, not so much environmental review, but everything else is like, where are we heading?
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a comfortable home there and a direct connection to the governor's office, which actually EQB is chaired by a representative of the governor, so we still have that. And it's just a question of we've had in the mid-'80s, we had a nice connection between the governor, the governor's lead staff for environmental issues, and the head of the planning agency at the time, Tom Triplett, for much of the time. To the chair, and Tom chaired EQB at the time. So there was a good line of chain of command thing that, and then there were issues that people wanted to deal with, and they wanted to use the interagency forum to do that. If there's not a great deal of interest in doing that, we sort of, you don't have that completing of the circuit. I mean, the thing that makes EQB special is the fact that we have 9 commissioners. And by the way, only the commissioners can vote on the EQB. They can't send deputies or alternates. They can come to the table, but they cannot vote. Mm-hmm. And then we have the 5 citizens, and then we have a chair who has – there have been numbers of different kinds of chairs. There have been chairs from directly out of the governor's office, which you would think being a representative of the governor would mean. But there's also been chairs, the head of the state planning agency, when Triplett was a chair – or line commissioners, starting with Chuck Williams in the early 90s and Rod Sando and now Commissioner Hugesson. And they just have to say, okay, I'm putting on my chair hat. I'm representing EQB. If you cut me, I'm bleeding EQB, not natural resources or agriculture or whatever. And that's part of the magic that makes EQB work. The other thing is an independent staff, so that it's not just collating what agencies do, but it has a capability of thinking through the issues and maybe saying we can have the luxury, with the exception of environmental review, we're non-regulatory. We do the state water plan. We do state biennial priorities reports. We work with our partners to do things that haven't been done, like comparing supply and demand on a county basis. We couldn't do that without an independent staff capability. If it's just to collate what agencies are already doing, there's some value there, but it's not the maximum value that EQB can have. So we had that in spades in the 80s, I'd say, and it's partly been as being homed in the planning agency. The flip side of that is whenever there was a freeze on government spending or lobbying, we honored that whether or not anybody else honored that. So we've been continually being whittled away. At one point, I think our maximum staff size was 30 to 35 people. That's when we were doing all the environmental review for everybody in the state. So that's inflated in that way. And that's also when we had energy facilities siting, which had as many as, at some point, a dozen people, I think. Now we're down to four, really five, if we can fill that executive director position. But that's still not a very decent threshold. It's one thing I do want to say is when we ran the Sustainable Development Initiative in the 90s, we had, with the power plant staff, we had 15 people. So it's three times the staff we have now. But we were able to draw on staff, and that is a strength of EQB, we had the staff from the Agriculture Agency staffing our agriculture team. We had the staff from the Economic Development Agency staffing our manufacturing team during the sustainable development thought process. We had forestry staff actually assigned to EQB, but from DNR on mobility to work on the forestry team. The settlement, the land use aspect, was an in-house state planning agency staff who served EQB. So we were able to draw on the staffs of agencies, and that's the way it should work. So you don't have to have it all be a big staff at the Environmental Quality Board for this institution to work. But it's important that there be an excitement and a motivation to work. And that is exactly what the recommendation of our subcommittee on future EQB directions has put forward, saying we can still be lean and mean, but we need to be the one big thing that we could be working on is that energy and environment strategy, to pull together what everybody else is doing and to add a little independent and collective reasoning to that process. And that also is something that we've thought could be useful in the vein of understanding how land use affects global climate change emissions, and how land use is something that everybody's interested in and nobody's in charge of at the state level. And it's something that Rod Sando, when he was commissioner of DNR, said was the single most important threat to the environment is land use. And that's probably still true today, or every bit as much true today, that and climate change, of course. And it's the kind of thing that an interagency citizen forum with direct connections to the governor's office ought to be very much focused on.
Which agencies are most responsive to the EQB's recommendations and lending staff and such, coordinating staff?
I don't know how to answer that, Mr. Chairman. It's the kind of thing that collectively, I guess at this point, you know, the Pollution Control Agency has been very supportive. They've asked us to get engaged in the issue of ethanol and water availability, to convene an interagency work group on water availability, starting from the ethanol thing, and we've broadened it to be all water uses because, in a sense, the resource doesn't know whether it's being whether groundwater is being pumped out for a particular purpose or not. It just responds to the pumping of that groundwater. So they've been very supportive of that. It's an interagency focus. We have people from the DNR, the PCA, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Health Department, the Department of Agriculture, the Metropolitan Council, even though they're not on the board, that we've asked them to join us, and the Minnesota Geological Survey and the U.S. Geological Survey. That's my work group for this water availability project, and we're going to be defining, hopefully based on, in part, on the work that we've done to date, and working with people at the University of Minnesota who are engaged in this research, to define a broad framework so that we can understand where these individual decisions are taking us, so that people can understand that. So all those partners, all the members of the agencies get involved in that situation, and I really have to thank them for that. It's not something they budgeted in advance, and yet they're going to be taking the next 6 months. We started this in the PCA adopted the resolution in November. We got the directive in December. We adopted it. We received it in front of the board and accepted the mandate in January. The board adopted the work plan in this past February, the third Thursday of the month in February. And we've had three work group meetings to date on this subject. DNR is doing a number of really excellent background reports to describe what they do today on water appropriation permitting and how things fit in. Like, how important is ethanol? Is the demand put on by ethanol facilities compared to other demands? And then we have the Board of Water and Soil Resources is taking a historical look. Have we been here before? Have we asked this question before in the last 25 years? If so, how was it asked and how was it answered? So that's being led by Eric Mooring of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. EQB staff is taking the lead for defining this broad framework, and we're going to be contracting with our Land Management Information Center. They're not staff of EQB, but they're GIS staff in the Department of Administration that can do the software to translate this into a geographic information system. So that what my dream is that you'll be able to take a window, let's say a 25-mile in diameter window, and move it over any part of the state and know what the demand is on the water resource in that point, around that point, a 12.5-mile radius, what the supply estimate is, and it's an estimate, and how close are we to using all of the supply we think we could use on a long-term sustainable basis. So that'll help people put into perspective these individual incremental decisions that we're making, and that's the hard thing. It's hard to do that. It's easier to look at one site and say, okay, if we put a pumping test in there, what wells in the neighborhood are going to be drawn down? But to think about, okay, what about another well 10 miles over or 15 miles over or 25 miles over, pumping X, Y, and Z amounts? And what about the future and future water demands? That's what this report took a crack at doing at the county scale. And we have that as a basis for defining this regional framework, but with all these partners helping us. And we are able to reach out beyond the state government realm to get the U.S. Geological Survey and the University of Minnesota engaged in this process as well. So that's how we are able to pull people together. And that's kind of a roundabout answer to your question, but that's, I guess, the best answer I can give.
Which agencies would you like to engage more?
Well, I'd like to engage DNR more. They have a different there is a cultural difference between those who are trying to do strategic planning and those who are regulating. And it's a different thing. The regulators want to know what's going to happen on this one spot. We're kind of looking back at we try to step back and look at the forest and not the trees. You have to know what the trees are doing. That's true. There's a relevancy to both. But our feeling is that, somebody ought to be looking at the forest, too. And I see that as, in general, an EQB job. So is the forest in general healthy or not? And that's the role that we're playing in the water arena with this water group. So there's that difference in perspective, and there's a difference in recognizing some data isn't good enough to draw conclusions at a local level. And the fear is that somebody will take our regional analysis or our countywide analysis, translate that to say, well, you have to make this decision on this one permit, and that's inappropriate. So we're trying to work more, trying to understand each other's perspectives. They're trying to understand our planning perspective, and we're trying to understand their regulatory perspective. Both are important, and they both eventually need to come together. And it's been a very tough process in the last couple of years, but we're making headway on it. We had a great meeting of the work group yesterday, and we'll see how that goes. So DNR is one. On the energy issue, we need to work more closely with Commerce to see how all these great climate change energy initiatives affect and are affected by the commissioners around the table at the Environmental Quality Board. I mentioned that before. So how that affects, how transportation affects climate change, how land use, which is not any one issue, but DNR has a big role in that, how that affects climate change and how climate change is affected by that, how habitat is affected by climate change. We are also actively participating in the University of Minnesota's LCCMR project for developing a statewide conservation protection strategy. I've been to a ton of meetings over the last year on that, and it's been an absolutely wonderful process. But that's a process of trying to think about the future, too. So how is this going to affect our natural resources? How is it going to affect land use? How should land use be changed so that it minimizes its contribution to climate change gases? Ditto with transportation and so forth. So there's a need to involve Commerce actively in that, or to be involved with Commerce's conversation actively in that discussion. I'm not so sure on the health front. The health commissioner is a member of our board, too, of course. We wouldn't want to get Environmental Quality Board involved in the issues they deal with PCA, for example, on PFCs, unless we needed to provide a broader step-back view of the issue. And at this point, we haven't engaged ourselves in that. But so how can we prevent that from happening in the future? That would be a question we would be asking. That maybe isn't well dealt with at the present time. I don't know, but so it's those kind of questions that we ask. And when we are responding with our PCA and Ag partners on doing biennial assessments of water quality trends, for example, we should be asking those questions about, well, where are the trends, what are they telling us? Often we find, well, guess what, we don't have enough data to actually even determine whether there are any trends. That's the frustrating thing. You frequently, for all the data being collected, we often don't have enough to make trends judgments. So we would tell you that, and that's the kind of thing where we would have that broad perspective. Yes, it may not affect how you regulate a point source discharge, but what is the sum total of all those discharges, and where is that taking us? How does that affect the whole Impaired Waters Initiative and so forth?
So safe to say EQB has kind of chosen a strategic focus of water for its activities primarily?
It happened that way because there was a water planning board established in the late 70s that was brought me to Minnesota right after grad school, actually. And they worked until 1983, at which point they were merged into the Environmental Quality Board, and the staff was merged at that time. And the Water Planning Board chair became the chair of the Environmental Quality Board, as a matter of fact, Tom Kalatowski. So that is why we have the separate 103A and 103B water duties. That's how those came about. In general, we have a broad sweeping set of authorities in 116C04 to look at environmental issues that cut across department lines. And so we could do the things in water planning without any specific authority, but, you know, the specific authority tends to be the one you respond to, and it's easiest to engage with. That's how that has evolved. I think the most important thing for us to think about in the future is getting involved in the energy and environment picture, which is not just energy as it affects the environment. It's a two-way street. So that's the point of that 116D sections 10 and 11 statute, is that we do that. And as the subcommittee of EQB recommended, that ought to be something we move into that we haven't done.
Okay. Senator Dibble, you had a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear water, I hear climate as it relates to land use, transportation, economic development. Sounds very very ambitious. It sounds like a significant role, kind of harkening back to some of the stuff that the EQB did a few years ago. You mentioned the visioning. I'm looking at the notes about the board retreat and a plan for recommendations for the future that are now under consideration by the board and the governor's office. Is there a way to get an indication of what those recommendations might be, or a preview, or, you know, I mean, the reason I ask is because I have a bill, actually, you might be aware of it, that talks about the EQB jumping in and participating in crafting policy as it relates to land use and how that relates to the environment, to the atmosphere, and global warming. And I believe strongly the EQB has played an important and strong role in the past. I don't know that we can magically make that happen again in the future through anything that we can do at the legislature other than providing resources and, you know, creating assignments. It seems like the EQB's authority and value and legitimacy are derived from leadership in the executive branch and whether or not the agency heads find value in the EQB, whether the governor is strongly supporting the EQB and making sure that it's positioned in the right place with the right resources, with the right, you know, with the direction from the governor's office to his commissioners that this is the place to go when I want stuff to come out of here. But nevertheless, it seems like an interesting and exciting potential. So what is being envisioned, and how is the governor receiving those recommendations, and when will we know more about that?
Mr. Wells.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dipple, what is being envisioned by the Subcommittee on Future EQB Directions is, I think, in part of your packet. It's called a Preliminary Proposal for Refocusing EQB, dated January 8, 2008, and it's got draft stamped all over it, so it is still a preliminary proposal.
Not sure we have it in our packets.
So, and Mr. Chair,
Yes, Senator Dillon.
I'm sorry if I missed it in the answer. So when are we going to know more about how the governor feels about the recommendations, the board itself, and
Mr. Chairman, I don't know when the governor is going to make a decision on that. I will say the governor's office said, we want you to do this. We want you to have a subcommittee that looks at how you can get EQB back to the way it was 20 years ago. And so they unleashed us to do this. And the chair of EQB, Gene Hugeson, chairs the subcommittee. And we've got Commissioner Moore and Commissioner McElroy, as well as our citizen member, John Bloomberg, on it. So they've had that initiation and the authority coming from the governor's office to start this. This has been in the governor's office a month or two, I'll say, and so I don't know, I can't read their minds, so I don't know what they're thinking about and what they're doing with it. And there's the copy of the paper.
Thank you.
Right. And it basically, if you look at the last page, actually, it says, you know what, we should look at climate change as the first thing we jump into. And, you know, obviously there's a ton of stuff happening on climate change, and it hasn't directly involved EQB, although it's involved six or seven of our commissioners. In fact, we've heard from the governor's office saying one of their frustrations is that there are always new task forces formed and if EQB were active, you wouldn't have to do that. and some of that's self-imposed, but it's not all self-imposed. So that's one of the things we're thinking of. And in fact, we say in here the best way to do it, to pull in all these miscellaneous authorities, and to get to this point, we looked at the statutory authorities of the Environmental Quality Board spread throughout state law, and I've got about a 20-page table that describes those point by point with a little mini evaluation of them, and that's on our website. And I can also email it to people or send you copies if you're interested. If you're really interested, I think I even maybe have brought them. But the way to pull those all together is through a strategic plan for energy and the environment, and that also is an opportunity. So then we can say, of all this stuff, what is really key for us to focus on? And what can we sort of let go on autopilot for a while? But that's the whole thrust of this document, is that we need to be strategically focused on broad, big picture energy and environment issues. And I would argue on the climate change thing with the MCAG recommendations on global climate change emissions, that involves everybody on our board in a very intimate way, either because it's going to screw up something that they're hoping will be well managed, or their discipline contributes to the problem, or both. And so how are we going to keep track of our progress as we go down the road in addressing that problem? The climate change package has been quite innovative and so forth, but how are we going to track it? The progress on implementing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe maybe the EQB could take on climate change as it is. Climate change is impacted by land use. That was a topic you identified as something that no agency has taken the lead on.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
That would be perhaps land use and climate change. Could be a niche that EQB focuses on, and that would also, I suspect, create an opportunity to engage the DNR more, which you identified as a need.
They're certainly a big actor in that whole arena, and I think that would be an excellent thing for the board to get engaged in.
It's not just climate change, because everyone's doing it, not just energy, because there's other people doing it, but climate change and land use, and certainly not enough people are talking about it. I haven't heard one. I don't think I've heard an agency talk about it. We've had the U of M studies. We've had forums, but I don't know if there's a real an agency really focusing on land use and climate change. And that sounds like it'd be a really interesting niche, Senator Dibble.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The truth of the matter is that we can have all of the transit in the world, but if we're not paying attention to land use and land use patterns, you know, transit isn't going to be of much help in addressing the contribution to climate change from the transportation sector. Mm-hmm. You know, transit is a means to different sorts of land use and development and redevelopment. But if we're not very intentional and conscientious about that. So I have two bills, which I would love the EQB to support. One is asking the Met Council to consider CO2 emissions when they're considering these comp plans and this regional planning function that they have. And then the other is asking the EQB to jump in wholeheartedly into that. But I still go back to my earlier statement that the EQB by definition and by function, or for better or for worse, is an executive branch entity. It's a table that exists in the executive somewhat, and its legitimacy and its value, the level that those executive branch agencies rely on it is somewhat voluntary unless there's strong leadership that comes from the executive, him or herself, from the governor. So we can do a lot of stuff here at the legislature, provide money, direction, et cetera. But if folks are at that table reluctantly or without strong leadership from the governor, the EQB, the EQB's fortunes will rise and fall according to the level of interest that the governor has in it and in its function.
Or fiscal note.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mr. Chairman?
I was just going to add before, when we're talking about land use, before our greater Minnesota members think that I'm just flagging agriculture, I think there's a lot we need to do in metropolitan areas in land use and climate change and water. And I think the urban areas and suburban areas need to do a lot more in terms of the way we use, reuse, discharge our water. And we discharge. We probably have more impermeable surface in the areas of the metropolitan area than the whole rest of Minnesota combined.
I think you're
so
right.
We have a lot of things that we need to improve on in metropolitan areas. And I'm going to commit this interim to talking about some strategies. I see Ms. Ferret is in the room as well, and we'll certainly be working with our builder friends to come up with some fair solutions. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we may even discover that high-density development and land use is far more detrimental in this department than is low-density. So it'd be quite interesting.
Maybe.
Mr. Wells, and then I think we should probably move on to our chief guest.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. The Environmental Quality Board was directed by law, I think 1999, to develop an urban development generic environmental impact statement. We spent 2 years with an interagency committee and scoped it out for $200,000. Most of that was paying staff time. We hired a staff person to manage that. The thing that was remarkable about it is we had the Sierra Club and the Builders Association agreeing on the need and the solutions, which was actually high-density development and not letting sprawl go, and the Commissioner of Agriculture, not letting sprawl go into farmlands piecemealing going into farmlands, which would then create all these. It's kind of like the infrastructure is easier to support and pay for if it's here, but if you're having to put it out here and hold that weight, it's an awful lot harder to manage it. So we've had that scoping document. It's posted on our website, but it's now dated. It's 6 years old at this point. And some stuff has gone on without it, and so it would need to be revisited. But we never actually did the GEIS to actually look at a number of things. We did consider things like how property taxes has this underlying insidious effect to actually encourage sprawl, and how we don't split the value between the buildings and the land inherent land value in itself, the site value taxation idea we looked into, and that the same guy who did the GEIS work did that for our team too. Mark Haveman, who is, you might have heard in other areas now. But so there are all sorts of ways of looking at that. We have gotten involved in land use issues in the past. We actually were involved with the development of the Community Based Planning Act, which was in existence for about 5 years before it was sunsetted. And actually, the communities at the county level that participated in that loved it. It was killed for other reasons, or sunsetted for other reasons. But that's something that people are now thinking about, including the University of Minnesota Conservation Strategy Project. How can we get back there? Do we need to call it conservation planning so it doesn't trip red flags or what? But how can we get back into that conversation about communities working in partnership with state agencies? One other thing I'll quickly mention that we did, coming out of the Governor's Roundtable on Sustainable Development, one of our meetings in the Lindale community in Minneapolis, and we talked to neighborhood organizations there, they were so frustrated because they were always middle priorities from the various state grant programs. But if anybody would actually take those single-purpose grant programs and look at them across the board, they felt they would have been a high priority. And that got us thinking. It got the Governor's Roundtable thinking that, you know what, we ought to have some opportunity to actually meet community needs instead of just our own individual wishes to grant individual programs or give grants to individual purposes, but do a kind of a comprehensive look at things. And that led to something called the Local Solutions Alliance, which the Ventura administration flirted with for a while. We looked at it in a few different communities, and Two Harbors being one. And I'll give you the example of that, even though it ended up not working out. The school district needed a new high school because it's in downtown Two Harbors, and because of the State Department of Education's rule that you need enough athletic field space, and they couldn't do that in downtown Two Harbors. So they were going to have to move to the fringe of Two Harbors. And the idea was to keep them as close to the city as possible. Well, as it turns out, they ended up – let me finish the thing. Keep them as close to the city as possible near the golf course in Two Harbors, and you could actually improve the golf course, make it a National Audubon Society-capable golf course. There was a landfill on the upper end of the golf course that could take PCA money to clean it up to make sure it didn't become a hazardous waste area. There was a need for a community center, which could be teamed with a need for a high school pool and a high school auditorium could become a community auditorium. They could share these facilities. And that was the kind of package that was put together. One of the leading citizens actually was Commissioner Moore's mother, excuse me. So there was a lot of neat activity going on in Two Harbors. As it turns out, the school district decided we just have to make our own decision, and they moved the school out of town. So it didn't happen. There was an opportunity for synergy there. That was the kind of thing that we tried to engender with the Sustainable Communities Act or local partnership idea, Local Solutions Alliance. And I'm going on. I'll cut it off there. But I wanted to know that there's a lot of opportunity here for tying things together, and land use and climate change would be a great thing.
Who is the EQB's legislative liaison?
We don't have one. Our legislative liaison in the Department of Administration is Jim Rhodes. So he is our legislative liaison. I should put it that way.
Okay. All right. So that's who we should contact. That's helpful to know.
That or me, but...
This conversation was important to have. We haven't really engaged the EQB in anything the last couple of years, and so we're part of it's my fault, and part of it we're discovering, you know, why it's not as active as it in our activities as it could be. So this was very helpful and to us, and hopefully you'll find it helpful. Of course, the more information you give us about yourselves, the more opportunity there is for the members here to meddle in your affairs. So hopefully that'll be a good thing in the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But I can speak for myself that our committee will definitely be interested in working with you a lot more in all of the things that we've been discussing this morning. I think it's very important, and where the committee is interested in the activities that you're working on, and we need to engage your agency more. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, did you indicate we might have some interim discussions? Maybe we can trot out some of the ideas in my bills, and if other people have ideas.
Yeah, let's do that.
Great.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you for volunteering.
One last point. The other little nuance that you don't see more of us is that we're in the general government budget divisions because we're in admin. So you don't ever see us when it comes to money. So that would be that's a kind of a missed opportunity, I guess, in some ways. But maybe there are ways around that.
We should address that.
Yeah, we can. We have Senator Anderson's finance division takes care of accounts that are not necessarily in the environmental agencies.
such as commerce, for example. So perhaps that's something we can talk about to change over,
yeah.
So that we can people with that the interest in the activities have more say over the funding.
That's a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll move on to confirmation of Environmental Quality Board members. Jonathan Bloomberg was the only prospect who was able to be here this morning, and we do appreciate the effort you've taken. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? We do have your resume here, and we're certainly interested in your thoughts and perspectives as well.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is John Bloomberg. Little bit of background. I'm an environmental attorney and actually also teach environmental law at the University of St. Thomas Law School. I've been a citizen member of the Environmental Quality Board since 2003, so you're being asked to confirm a reappointment at this point. And as Mr. Wells indicated, among the other things I've done as a citizen member, I've served on this subcommittee we were just discussing, looking at revisioning the EQB and trying to, fair way to say it is to make the EQB more relevant. And I think part of the discussion we've had today is specifically focused on that question. And so we've put a lot of effort and time, and actually I'm one of the folks who is one of the authors of this report that Mr. Wells passed around. And my own view, which I think is perhaps somewhat naive, good government view that everybody who's got a hand in the environmental arena ought to be talking to each other and ought to be coordinating with each other on a regular basis. And we have in this state an entity that already exists that doesn't exist in most states that already mandates all of those folks to come together to the same table with authorities that exist that give this coordinating role and the strategic planning role already to somebody. And so we've got a leg up on most other states who want to engage in that sort of process. And I guess what I would say is we've got a lot of unfulfilled promise at this point. And I'm excited about continuing to work on this effort. And I think that's probably, in terms of my energies spent over the next few years, now if I am reconfirmed, will be spent in that way. With that, I guess I will end my statement. Certainly be willing to address any questions, and thank you for your time.
You certainly have impressive qualifications. Why don't you just kind of tell us what your activities have been on the EQB thus far and what you would like to continue doing, what you new things you would like to do.
Sure. A lot of what we focused on in my first term on EQB was for all of the energy siting issues that now have been withdrawn from EQB. So we spent a lot of time there. That's the, I think once that energy siting authority was taken, was moved over to PUC, that prompted us to ask the question, okay, what do we do to make ourselves more relevant? So a lot of my effort, and actually the reason that I sought appointment to EQB in the first place, was this notion of strategic planning and trying to get agencies to coordinate environmental policy and figure out how to make environmental policy more efficient. So have been working on that. Since last spring, I also was elected vice chair of the EQB. So that's a largely honorary position, I've come to find out, other than if Chair Hugeson cannot make a meeting, I chair the meeting. But other than that, not much associated with that title. But my focus, again, over the last year has been working on this subcommittee. We've been meeting monthly and leading up to the generation of the report that was passed around. And again, that would be my primary focus, I think, over the next 3 years, is to try to make this strategic planning process that we have envisioned that and that I believe is already provided for by statute real and vital and revitalize the EQB in that way.
What was the novel Clean Air Act compliance agreement for large industrial facility providing for emission reduction commitments that you were working on?
Just a little background about my process or my practice. I do regulatory compliance work, mainly preventive law, working with industrial clients largely. And that particular project was a project for Anderson Windows. They're a client of mine. It was under the auspices of something called Project XL, which was a pilot program introduced by EPA in the Clinton administration, about midway through the Clinton administration, soliciting proposals from industrial clients willing to make commitments to basically do better than environmental regulations would otherwise require them to do. So the catchphrase was superior environmental performance. Commit to superior environmental performance in exchange for limited flexibility on the permitting side. So what we did with the Anderson facility in Bayport was establish a facility-wide cap and then do an entire air toxics evaluation around their activities, ensuring that we've demonstrated to the community that the facility is safe, the emissions are capped, and in exchange for that, received a 10-year permit that established a plant-wide applicability limit on emissions. So as long as they stay within that cap, they are able to make facility changes. So that was that project.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bloomberg, I would just like your perspective on the dynamics of the board when you combine people in administration and agencies and citizens, and if you feel the citizens' weight to issues is heard, and if you're allowed to develop thought processes in that mix, and if it works well for you.
I'd say the short answer is yes. I was just talking with the staff folks before. The only hitch is nobody ever knows quite what to call us. commissioners are commissioners, and member doesn't quite sound right. So, but other than that, no. I think that it's my experience has been that we are all colleagues at that table as these issues arise, and frankly, a lot of the good questions come from the citizen members. I think there's a value in having citizen members at that table because they come with a very different perspective and have no kind of constituency other than their own experience, really, that they're represented. And I would say that works well. The one disadvantage we have, of course, is that all of the commissioners who come to that table have significant staff that back them up on various issues. And while we can and do rely on EQB staff to brief us and get us up to speed, we don't have that same level of resource necessarily available to us. I'm not sure that's good or bad, but that's one difference.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Scogin, yeah.
Mr. Bloomberg, do you think there's a piece of a puzzle missing at that board table, a perspective that's not being recognized, or
Mr. Bloomberg?
Mr. Chair, Senator, No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that the net is cast pretty broadly in terms of the agencies who are invited to participate. So, from that perspective, I think all of the folks within state government, well, the only agency who doesn't sit at the table who is involved fairly regularly in the issues that EQB deals with on the planning side is Met Council. I don't know if they need a seat at the table or not, but that's that's, in my experience, that's the only entity that is significantly involved that doesn't necessarily sit at the table. But I haven't seen that to be a barrier to coordinating with them on issues as they arise.
Senator Dibble and then Senator Ingebrigtsen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you live in my district now, or do you live in Matamidi?
I used to live in Matamidi, but okay. About 4 years ago, yes, we moved to your district. We're on Holmes.
Great. Well, welcome to the neighborhood.
No, thank you.
I see that you negotiated or helped do some of the MSP work. So how is the airplane noise over your house there? You're right under the track.
Absolutely fine.
All right.
I do have to say I do represent the Airports Commission, so yes. Okay. Just, Senator, briefly, I've had a lot of interesting conversations with my clients since moving into the district.
Good. That's great. Glad to have you in that specific location. I was curious about one item, Mr. Chair, on your professional activities listing. What is the Pollution Control Agency Reinvention Advisory Committee? What do they do?
They exist still to advise the agency on environmental innovation activities. That what they do now has morphed a bit from when I participated on that committee. I was participating at a time when the agency was very much involved in the kind of permit projects that I just described that I helped Anderson Windows out with, and looking at doing that on a broader scale. Piloting it first with a number of entities and then seeing if there are learnings that could come from that and extend out to do other types of innovative permits. I think currently that advisory committee looks more at issues of environmental management and how you can utilize environmental management systems within a company to promote environmental performance, that sort of thing.
Okay. You know, actually, you're at 32nd in Holmes.
Yes.
So you're a little outside of the flight track. I think flight track more would catch at 42nd in Holmes, unless they're coming in. So.
Yeah, but when we go to the Lake Harriet Bandshell in the summertime.
Oh, you bet.
So, experience it, yes.
I'm just going back to the Reinvention Committee. You know, there has been some concern, not that this has anything to do with your role in the EQB, but, you know, there's been concern about the PCA and, trying to take off its regulatory hat and put on we're the friend to industry, and not quite hitting the sweet spot there. I understand some of the impulse to the advisory, so it's not constantly adversarial, and yet rather than enforcing permit violations, you get, you know, you have the actions taken up front, so everything is done right from the get-go rather than waiting for errors to be made in environmental responsibilities by corporations. Have you found is the Reinvention Committee helpful to find that right balance? Is that kind of the role? I mean, this has been a big, very hot debate, as you're probably well aware, over the past few years. What is the role of the PCA? What demeanor? It took in the Office of Environmental Assistant. Right. Everyone was very worried that, the PCA is now going to become everyone's buddy and not enforce anything anymore. So is that kind of the role of the Reinvention
Committee? Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know if that's the specific role of the Reinvention Committee. I suspect that's something they can look at, and I know that it's something that the Pollution Control Agency continues to struggle with. I personally am not fond of calling the regulated community customers. I think that sends the wrong message to everybody. They are the regulated community. My opinion is, and this is coming from somebody who works on the side of representing industry, mostly all folks who want to do the right thing, thankfully. To me, it's all about resources on the issuing permits and enforcement side. It's very much, I think a carrot and a stick are both necessary. I think carrot works with a lot of folks, but ultimately, if you want the Pollution Control Agency to fulfill their mission, I think they need the bodies to do it.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, when the moment is right, I'd like to make the motion to recommend.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bloomberg, just a question, probably just because I don't know the whole workings here, but there was some mention probably by the earlier presenters about the counties now having control of their water quality destiny decisions, things like that. That was given to them some years ago. And correct me if I'm wrong, but are those decisions being made in your opinion with some kind of uniformity throughout the state of Minnesota? Or, I mean, you have 67 different county boards making decisions with regards to water quality. Is that concerning at all to you? When you could very potentially have 45 different ways of handling water quality decisions.
Mr. Bloomberg.
Mr. Chair, Senator, before Mr. Wells jumps in, maybe he can help me with some facts, but let me give you the conceptual answer. I think there's always a challenge when you've got multiple layers of government and multiple types of authority, I guess, going after the same issue. And so when you think about water issues, I mean, it's both, wetland, well, it's a lot of things. It's the wetland issue, which multiple jurisdictions have a hand in. It's all of the land use issues we were talking about previously, everything down to issuing a building permit. And so a lot of those issues made at local levels have the potential to be inconsistent one with another. You may get a different answer in Crow Wing County as opposed to Lake County, depending on what sort of water quality issues they're driving. Sort of a long, rambling answer to say, I think that always ought to be a concern in terms of consistency. I think there are probably specific issues both where consistency has been driven and where there may still be challenges. And I suspect the biggest challenge is probably on the land use side still and trying to drive some consistency around land use decisions that affect water. I don't know if Mr. Wells has something to add.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the only thing I would say is the Comprehensive Local Water Management Act doesn't give counties regulatory authority. So it's just it gets them to think about their water resources, and it asks them to build that thinking into their comprehensive plans. So it's a planning law. So it doesn't give them that law doesn't give them regulatory authority on anything. It's a planning law. Now there are other vehicles, like they can receive the delegation of administering feedlots, and there's a wetland role, but those are under other statute. And John's answer was, I couldn't even do as well myself on that. But I just wanted to point out that the Comprehensive Local Water Management Act of 1985 was a planning law.
Thank you.
All right. Further questions for Mr. Bloomberg? Mr. Bloomberg, final comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The other candidates had legitimate reasons for not being here today. However, I do have a question that needs to be clarified with Susan McCarville on her economic interest form. It states her source of compensation is the city of Eden Prairie, but it also says in her resume that she is the owner of Max Liquor Store in Hopkins, and that's not listed as a source of compensation. That could just be a clerical error, and it's certainly not, I'm not concerned about it, but I think it needs to be clarified before we move forward with that confirmation. So we're going to have another hearing to hear from Ms. McCarville at that time, and I think we might as well just take the other two as well, since they're not here, and we'll find a time that all three can actually be here. Ms. McCarville's daughter went into labor, I understand, today, and so that's why she wasn't able to be here. So otherwise, she had been scheduled and could have clarified that. So not that I have any concerns about the other these three that are not here, but if we're going to take one at a different time to clarify an issue, why don't we just take the other two as well and have a similar discussion that we had with Mr. Bloomberg.
Mr. Chair, I did have a visit from Mr. Wenzel.
I did too, yes.
Spent about 20 minutes with him, so
yeah.
I would be comfortable confirming it,
yeah.
But if you want to wait, that's fine.
Yeah, we might as well. I mean, I don't want to move forward on Ms. McCarville till that economic interest thing is clarified. Not that I'm concerned, but it has to be clarified before we move forward. And we'll hold another hearing for her. So Senator Dibble will move. What is the proper language? Senator Dibble will move that the confirmation of Jonathan Bloomberg to the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board be recommended. Is that correct?
And sent to the floor.
And then this will be this motion will be sent straight to the floor. A recommendation to confirm will be sent straight to the floor. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, as we all got a visit from Dennis Wenzel and got a chance to discuss this with him, why wouldn't we confirm him?
Well, I wouldn't have a big problem with that, but if we're going to have another hearing for Ms. McCarville, why don't we give the other two an opportunity as well, Ms. Gehring and Mr. Wenzel, an opportunity to come forward, and we can ask them have a similar discussion as well. I think that would be a decent due diligence.
Mr.
Dibble, Senator Dibble.
Yeah, I had a nice visit with Mr. Wenzel too, but I think a hearing is qualitatively different. There are opportunities that come up in a setting like this than in a
Absolutely.
Private one-on-one conversation. Yeah. Office. So I think that's appropriate.
Yep. Okay. So next item on the agenda is Senate File 3811. Thank you to the Environmental Quality Board for this discussion. We absolutely had to have this discussion, so we appreciate you being here and being so forthright.
All right.
Senator Scogin, you're going to present from Senator Skoy?
Yeah, he got called to finance. He had a LGA and some other issues he wanted to make sure he was there for. This is also important, and I left my glasses upstairs, so I may call on Senator Ingebretson to help me read it if we get into real specifics.
Borrowed.
Cheers.
This is, Mr. Chair, this is the continuing effort to control bovine tuberculosis in the state of Minnesota. Senator Skoy has been a key player in getting the cattle producers and the hunters and the DNR and others together to try to get this eradicated. And as you know, a few weeks ago when we were putting together our omnibus bill, he had other provisions that had come up that he wanted, and here are some more that have come up in Senate File 3811. And it talks about a lot of different things, but it includes expanding the wildlife feeding radius right up in the TB, bovine TB area. It also, of course, includes some provisions about what kind of penalties could be imposed if people continue to feed in that area. Now, I will make a note that on line 123, Senator Skoy indicated to me before he left for finance that the $500 penalty, Senator Mao suggested that come out of there just because there were some problems with including that in this piece of legislation. So I'd make an oral amendment to strike on line 1.23. Is subject to a civil penalty of $500 and the person.
So your motion would be to take out the civil penalty and the penalty remaining for feeding wildlife in the in this TB zone would be the loss of a hunting license for 2 years.
That is correct.
And this is any hunting license.
of a wild animal, yes.
Yep. Okay. Right, everyone understand the motion? And then we would not then have to send this bill to judiciary.
That is correct.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you. Then, as we walk down through C and D, you'll see there's some language there about giving DNR a broader authority to designate a disease area, disease zone, and some of the management and emergency practices that they could take at that point, including, you might notice, I think we just need to be very transparent about some of the things that we're going to attempt to do to eradicate bovine TB, including, you'll see, the ability to go onto private land without permission. And that is going to cause some anxiety in some areas, and there are some cattle producers up there now who don't want to be bought out and want to stay in the business, and of course Senator Scoy is working with them as well. But I do wish he was here to give it the full vetting that it deserves, but it does, as it goes to the floor, I'm sure rules want to take a look at some of this, and there's going to be some more discussion on this particular piece of our attempt to control bovine tuberculosis. I'd stand for any questions that I might be able to answer.
We talked about this in the Game and Fish Budget Oversight Committee, and every time the topic comes up, there's this dead silence that comes over the room every time we bring up. We brought up the topic twice at that BOC meeting, and every time we talk about some of these issues, there's just this dead silence, and nobody likes what's going on with this, and some of the things that we're having to do is just
very invasive.
It's invasive, and no one likes it, and even the sharpshooters who are shooting deer are not they describe the process as gross. This is not a fun thing that we have to go through, and the reason we're doing this is so that we don't have to do this statewide.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Senator Saxog had a question, but I know that Ed Bogus could answer. He helped Senator Scoy put this particular part together, so if you have questions of the DNR, too.
Senator Saxog and then Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just referring down there to 1.17 and 1.19, and was wondering, when we're talking about the commissioner may enter any lands to carry out duties and functions, I'm assuming we're meaning private property there, too.
Senator Saxog, counsel indicates yes.
Okay, so did you hear the question, Senator Scoy?
Senator Scoy.
It was about the private property idea.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogan, I'm assuming you're referring to the provision on page 1, line 17 through 19.
Yes, sir.
And here's the issue. As we've been working this last while to control the number of animal deer that are in the area, there are some private landowners that are resisting. They're not cooperative. And we've got this health issue in our wild deer herd and in our cattle, and we're trying to eradicate bovine TB. And the way you do that is you reduce the number of animals, whether they're cattle or deer. And in order to really accomplish the reduction in the wild deer herd, we need to get onto all the lands because they just congregate on these like little reserves. And I know this is controversial. I know that people have heartburn over going onto private land without permission. But we don't know what to do because we've been trying to work with these landowners. I think we're to the point now where the commissioner of DNR is contacting them. The next step is that the governor is going to talk to these landowners about the importance of allowing us to do some work in their wild deer herds. If we can't get success in that ratio, we have this provision that we would like to have available to use if we're unsuccessful in everything else. This really is the last resort. Nobody likes this type of activity, but we don't know what to do. Some of these parcels are large, 4,000 acres perhaps, and there's a lot of deer, there's a lot of food plots on there, and we're unable to do anything about that, and it's really inhibiting our efforts to finally get at this bovine TB issue. And it's really a really, really last resort.
Do we, Senator Scoy, or even the DNR, do we want to think about adding a commissioner to this decision, another commissioner to the decision somehow? Thinking about, maybe one commit, if two commissioners or more agree, or the animal health or ag or someone, do we want to have that type of safeguard so that at least the criticism can't be brought that it's the DNR who killed my deer?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a really good idea. I'm not exactly sure whether the board or the commissioner of ag or
the governor,
attorney general, I don't know where we would go for that.
Council mentioned even the governor. I mean, you mentioned that the governor was going to make some calls, and so if this, we're going to use this invasive extreme measure as a last resort, I imagine those instances will be limited enough that perhaps the governor's personal signature could be put. Maybe we just need to think about it a little bit.
Rather than
do it on the fly.
Mr. Chair, what I would recommend is that you put the Commissioner of Ag in there now, and then let's think about whether we would add the governor's involvement with his commissioners somehow or something. But I think adding the Commissioner of Ag would be kind of the minimal step, because this is pretty substantial action going on here.
Which is consultation or approval or...
I think we need to do more than consultation.
Not sure I understand.
I think it's got to be some other person's approval.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was getting that the Board of Animal Health, because this is an animal health issue, might be the appropriate agency to be signing off on it in conjunction with DNR.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scoy, on these private parcels, where as a last resort we may have to send people in without permission, are they farm? Is it typical farmland or is it recreational land?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, typically it's individuals that have large parcels of land with hunting camps, and so it would be more recreational land and not productive farmland. But there probably is some small parcels that is agriculture on those large parcels, hayland and that sort of thing.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is for Mr. Bogus, but in lines 2.5 here, you refer to Senator Scoy, the commissioner may declare an emergency. How does that work? I mean, take me through that. And is that going to give us the authority then to give the authority to the sharpshooters to go on personal property? Is that when that kicks in? Is that how that works?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, for the record, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for DNR, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the
delegate to the executive director, some of
the emergency zone language on lines 2.3 to 2.11 is for related to establishing no wildlife feeding areas, and there could be other activities within those areas, but it's really a separate issue from the section of the bill that relates to entry onto lands without permission.
Yeah, that's the other issue.
Currently, we do establish no feeding
that first
zone by rule.
1.17.
And we did that. There was a statutory authority that Senator Scoia had authored a couple years ago when PD was first found that directed the department to prohibit feeding within a certain minimum area. We squared that off because we do have some broader authorities and we have a no feeding zone. I have some maps of some of these areas if it would be useful to the committee. But so we've already got a no feeding zone, but that had to go through a rulemaking process. It was an 18-month rule. It's going to expire in May. We're going to have to redo that rule. We may expand that area. What this item C of the bill would do is allow us to set up those zones by publishing them in the state register and then automatically have the feeding ban go into effect, which is the remainder of the language in items 1, 2, and 3. Currently, the language that's in items 1, 2, and 3 there is in DNR rules. This would actually set that up so that we wouldn't have to promulgate a rule every time that we did a zone to control the feeding, but it doesn't deal with the sharpshooting or the other removal options.
Mr. Pagas, would this allow the DNR then to do a statewide feeding ban?
Mr. Chair, it would if we set this whole state up as an emergency zone.
Okay, so this is only for an emergency
zone. It's not really designed for a statewide application.
Okay. All right, Senator
Scoia. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and members, if you remember when I was in front of the policy committee a few weeks ago that Friday, we had a discussion about the extending of the feeding bans from 15 to 30 miles and then a little broader discussion about a statewide feeding ban. We kind of decided that we probably wouldn't move forward at this time with the statewide feeding ban, but we also recognize that the deer herd in Minnesota is getting larger and the animals are more concentrated. And as you have concentrations of animals, you have disease issues. And also coming in across from Wisconsin is chronic wasting is not very far away from Minnesota. So we thought that this language would kind of give the commissioner the ability in the smaller areas to establish these emergency zones so that we could have a... no feeding of wild animals in those areas and in a smaller scale than going statewide. And while statewide technically might be a possibility, that's not what my intent is with this language.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scoia, really, it's to allow the DNR to act quickly, too. That's we're not coming back here and having another discussion. It's just giving them the authority, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, that's correct.
Mr. Bogus, salt or other minerals are not feed. Can TB not be spread by salt?
Mr. Chair, I don't think Dr. Hartman is in the room any longer. He might be able to answer that more definitively than I could, but our understanding is it can persist in feed under certain conditions, particularly if it's cool and moist and not directly subjected to sunlight. This language actually parallels some language that we have for our baiting restriction, and we also have applied it to the feeding restriction. But I'm not a disease expert, so I don't know what the life of the bacteria that causes TB is on a salt block.
Any cow people know if cows like salt licks?
Yeah, they do.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm not a cow.
And Mr. Chair, I would just point out that what's in the bill right now corresponds to our existing rule up in the northwest zone. We have a no-feeding zone, but certainly we would be open to looking at modifying either the boundaries of the zone or the conditions if there was a good reason to do so.
What's an example of a mineral in the line 2.16, liquid sense salts and minerals?
Mr. Chair, a lot of the blocks that you can buy for cattle or some people put them out for deer are a mixture of salt and calcium and other minerals to try to enhance antler growth or other trace minerals for the health of the animals.
Okay. Senator Dibble?
My question was about the salts as well, but I also had a comment that to an earlier comment that this is extraordinary, but it's an extraordinary circumstance. I think Senator Rest's bill on the floor having to do with viral hemorrhagic septicemia in fish, another instance. You know, we're losing the moose herds. I don't know if that has any implication for livestock or not, but that's something extraordinary that's happening as well. So we've got some stuff that seems unprecedented going on in our state, and we're going to have to take some strong action on those. And, you know, it's important to have these debates, and they're going to be controversial, but I suspect we're going to have more of this.
Mr. Bacchus, is anyone studying this zone for other controls as well? Meaning, are we going to learn anything more about what is and isn't spread due to what we're removing here in this zone? For example, are we going to, will there be any improvement to the moose herd or the elk herd or anything else by not feeding in certain areas? Are we studying that at all as we move forward with this?
Mr. Chair, we don't have any specific studies along those lines. The only other species we're looking at currently is elk, which also we have two or three small elk herds now in the northwest part of the state. We used to only have the one around Grigla, and Grigla is right in the heart of where this TB event is occurring. So we have been sampling the elk that we've been able to get our hands on either through hunting or shooting permits, or elk that are found dead. We don't have any other research associated with the snow feeding zone at the present time.
It just seems like we could try and get broader information out of this, and if we're going to do this extraordinary activity, let's get as much information, data as possible, and put as many kind of lines in the water as possible to gather data and see what else we can learn from this. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a real good point. I know there's a moose study going on in the northwest corner as to why there's not the population there used to be with regards to the northeast section of the state. So that would be one of the questions I would have, if there might be some indication that it might be affecting the moose population as well. But I think that's more of a deadly disease. I think it affects the animal itself.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, there was a very extensive study in the northwest on moose, and that study has been published now as a wildlife monograph, and there is an ongoing study in the northeast moose, and those two populations are disjunct, and the northwest population of moose has pretty much crashed. We estimate 80-some moose based on aerial surveys that are a statistically stratified sampling scheme, but we only actually saw about 15 moose in our last survey, and they're very rare now in northwest Minnesota. And there were a number of potential causes of that decline identified, a lot of them just seemingly related to overall stress of the animals, low pregnancy rates, high parasite loads, implications of a species on the southern periphery of its range perhaps dying back due to longer, there were longer growing seasons documented just during the course of the study, and moose go under some heat stress anytime temperatures are above 70 degrees. So we think there may have been some stress just due to the weather or climate or whatever, however you want to characterize it, that was contributing to the effects of the parasites and causing the low pregnancy. Also some concerns about trace elements, although we're less convinced on those because that population was very healthy for a long period of time. We don't know if there's been any change in the soils or the minerals that were available to them. So we don't really have very many moose in this area that we're talking about any longer.
Is the DNR able then, can you go back and maybe talk with some of your staff and see what other parameters you could set for whatever you're studying and see if we can gather as much information as possible from this one activity? And Maybe it can, maybe it can contribute to the broader knowledge.
We can certainly. We are handling a lot of animals, and it is very, very labor-intensive on both the wildlife and the livestock front. So we can certainly talk about that. And we're also as an aside on the moose issue, we are going to call together the leading moose researchers and have a discussion about things we can. What are the highest priority needs for moose research as well?
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the concerns that has come up, this obviously takes priority. I mean, we have to get our hands on top of the TB issue. But in the surrounding areas, in fact, I think all over in northwestern Minnesota, there's large concerns about the number and the volume of deer in that area, and they go from way up in the very extreme northwestern part of the state all the way down along the valley. I was in a number of communities last weekend, and it's not unusual at all to have people report that they don't see deer in singles or triples or couples. They see them in herds. I mean, literally herds of deer. And the concern is that that if we don't do something to kind of get those numbers back in a more healthy state, we're going to have a lot more problems, probably with other diseases. Plus, we've got a lot of farmers that are outside of this area that are concerned because of their livestock, because they're feeding, the deer are feeding in the cattle feed and with the cattle and so on. So I'm wondering if the department has thought of the bigger picture up in northwestern Minnesota. Suggestions that were brought up to me is that before you could shoot a buck, that you'd have to shoot a doe or... and I'm not sure what the management schemes would be, but I think the concern was to try to drive down that just the sheer numbers so that they wouldn't be, just in our own case, we were watching, we have the same situation on our farm, and it's nothing to count, 20, 30 deer out in the hay field at one time. But last year we had triples. And I'm sure it's probably because of the nice winters and stuff. But now with spring coming again and the winter being relatively easy on them, I don't think we've seen many. The biggest culprit of deer, I think, is the automobile. They're literally along the roads. You can see them where they've been hit all over the place. But I'm just wondering if the department could take a look at that and figure out some way to try to get some of that pressure off.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, that is something that we're aware of and that we are looking at a number of potential options. We've had for the last 3 years, we've been trying different things in different areas, and our research people have been evaluating the effectiveness of those. Those have included early antlerless hunts, earn a buck where you have to shoot a buck before you can, or where you have to shoot a doe before you can, or an antlerless deer before you can shoot a buck. Antler point restrictions, which we're interested in primarily because it may force people to shoot more antlerless deer because they can't just shoot the first little buck that comes along, but which also could have a benefit for people that want to see bigger bucks, and we're hearing from some of those people as well. And all of that's been being evaluated and studied, and the statistics are being analyzed, and those are going to be done this year. And our intent is next year to start going from those being pilots, and some of them have been in the northwest part of the state in certain permit areas, but going from using those as pilots to using those as actually operational, which the ones that have the most promise to increase antlerless deer harvest. One of the problems we have, as we've liberalized, we have five deer limits and things like that. But one of the problems that we have is just getting enough hunters in the area and enough access to the lands in the area. There's a number of landowners that kind of hold that land pretty closely, and they allow some hunting, but not maybe as much as we'd like them to. And so that's the challenge that with any of these regulatory changes that we might propose, I don't know in all areas that we're going to be able to overcome that challenge. That's actually maybe more of an issue in the southeastern part of the state, where there's a lot of land that's recreational land that's very difficult to get very many hunters on. But we also, in the northwest, have an issue with just getting enough hunters afield. But we are looking at holding special seasons and earn a buck antler restrictions. All those options are on the table.
Mr. Chairman, just curious, how would what is the price for an out-of-state hunting permit? Would it be possible to maybe, because we've got two large population centers, you know, Fargo actually in Grand Forks, to if we would lower that, and I don't know what the price is, but would it be such that we could maybe make it more attractive for pulling in more hunters?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, the current price is, I believe, $135 for an out-of-state or non-resident deer hunting license, which is actually cheaper than I think any of our surrounding states. But certainly I'm sure that's a barrier to some non-residents coming in. We only sell, I don't know the exact number, but out of the 450,000 or so deer hunters that we have in the state, only about 12,000 of those, I think, in that ballpark are non-residents. So, you know, even if we double or triple our non-resident hunters, it's not going to be a huge percentage increase in the harvest.
Senator Saxog, did you have something?
I was just going to, Mr. Chair, move Senate File 3811 as amended and passed and sent it to the Rules Committee.
Aye.
Senator Scoy?
I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, the motion would be to the floor, and the Rules Committee will catch it as a late bill.
Oh, all right.
Okay. But, Mr. Chair, if I could just add to the department while we're here talking on this issue. First is that what we really need is a winner, because that's the only thing that's going to deal with it, in my opinion. But I was wondering if the department would be willing to look at a streamlined permitting process for cattle producers that are in a much larger area outside of this bovine TB control zone, because we've got deer feeding and cattle supplies all over, and it's not the economics of them eating the hay, which is important. It's a health issue at this point. And if you could streamline the permitting process for these ranchers who have deer in their haystacks to go out there every once in a while and take a shot at them and chase, you know, if they kill one, they kill one, but mostly just chase them away would be very helpful.
About the access part.
We need to talk about a couple of possible amendments. One was the on page one, the approval of another entity. I think, did Senator Scoy, did you suggest something to the effect of with the approval of the Board of Animal Health?
Mr. Chair, that would be my suggestion, is if it would read the Commissioner and the Board of Animal Health. And I don't know if there's a director or
something. It would be the Commissioner would enter the lands to carry out the duties, but it would be with the approval of the Board of Animal Health. So if someone would like to move on line 1.17 after Commissioner, insert with the approval of the Board of Animal Health.
I'd move that.
Senator Stumpf will move that. Is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only other thing Chernoff. I wanted to add is this is a broad provision. It doesn't just apply to bovine tuberculosis. It applies to any disease that's found. And I didn't know if you wanted to limit this only to the bovine tuberculosis or if you wanted to keep it broad, because some of these the Board of Animal Health may not have much involvement in, because it's basically all game and fish diseases.
I was going to address that next and suggest that disease be deleted and bovine tuberculosis be inserted.
but we could do that in one amendment.
I think that's a good idea.
Senator Stumpf?
I'd include that.
Okay, so the amendment, Senator Skoy, is what we said with the approval of the Board of Animal Health, and then on line 1.19, delete disease and insert bovine tuberculosis.
I'm supportive of.
Mr. Meyer?
No. Mr. Chair, members, I do understand the importance of this for bovine TB, but these authorities will help us deal with other diseases as they come forward. Chronic wasting disease is one county away in southern Minnesota from us in Wisconsin and heading this way rapidly. The state of Wisconsin kind of has thrown up their arms on a chronic wasting disease and said we can't control it, and it will be here sooner rather than later. So with that in mind, and the Board of Animal Health authorities, I don't know if the committee would be comfortable with allowing it to remain for disease. Otherwise, we'll have to be back here searching for those authorities, and it may not give us the tools we need to effectively eradicate that disease when it does hit our borders.
I prefer you come back. If it's a problem, you know, let us know. Let us know. We'll
hopefully it doesn't happen in June, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, but if this was an issue, I presume the department would have brought it forward this session.
Could see disease that affects livestock.
I don't know. I think we need to keep this narrow. I really do. I understand what Mr. Meyer is saying. I agree, and I would probably support that. But I think in this situation, we have a limited hearing. We have limited time. I think we just need to keep it to this. If there's a groundswell that we need to expand this to chronic wasting, no problem. But I think the understanding is for this hearing, this is the dealing with TB. Okay, so that's the Stumpf Amendment. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. I think on line 2.16, it seems to me that salt and minerals needs to come out. And I don't know if cows like liquid scents as well. Oh, maybe they do. I wouldn't think they did, but I mean, if someone is hanging the little cloth thing that you dip in the estrus on a tree,
might be curious.
Do cows generally go up and are they attracted by that by deer estrus as well?
Well,
I don't know, Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and members, my understanding of the way this transmits is if you have hay or feed and the saliva will get off of one animal down into the feed source, and another animal will come along, and it'll survive in that cool, damp climate of the hay or the feed. They'll eat it or breathe it, and that's how it transmits. I doubt that on salt, if it's going to survive. I don't know that. I don't personally care if salts or minerals are in but or out, but I think that that's not where the primary concern is for transmission of the disease. It's in the feedstocks where the hay is stored and the deer will come and feed, and then they'll feed the hay to the cattle, or where they string out a bale of hay and the cattle and the deer will intermingle there, or if there's a feeding box that has corn in it where you could get animals that would come and feed in the corn, the saliva would be in the corn, it would survive in that cool, damp environment, okay. And then another animal would come along and eat there.
Okay. Senator Stumpf, and then we'll ask the DNR what their
information I think
is.
We may run into trouble here with salt and minerals because a lot of there. If you look on that map, there's other cattle herds, and I don't know how big an area this would be in, but cattle farmers, you know, typically put mineral and salt out in their pastures. And if you read the language, it says a person may not place or distribute feed in an area that's frequented by deer or elk. Well, almost every pasture land up there would be frequented by deer because they just jump over the fence and run across your pasture. So if you happen to have a mineral block or a salt block out there, you could be guilty of violating this law.
Well, there is they do have the proviso down below, Senator Stumpf, about feed being present as a result of normal agricultural practices.
So that went, okay, all right.
And it's, you know, placed for domestic livestock that are present and actively consuming the feed. So no one can say it's for my cows, but it's really for the deer. And they do it on a daily basis. It's covered to deter deer or elk from gaining access and stored consistently with normal agricultural practices. I think that, and I think that was an important discussion I thought we encountered in the Ag Committee too, that how do we balance this feeding ban with the need to feed your cows? And so this language seems to cover that well. The only question I had was, is if salt and minerals is going to play the same role as other feed. Mr. Bogus, what's your information on that?
Mr. Chair, in terms of that sentence, you know, salt and minerals are things that are designed to be licked by cattle or deer or whatever. What I don't know is the survival of bacteria on salt or mineral. Liquid scent functions a little differently. That's more of something that's an attractant for deer. I doubt cattle pay much attention to it, but I don't know for sure. But even
so, it's not
even
really
for
a
deer,
licking
it's not
item.
Something that they come and lick. It's something that they come and smell or attracts them to the area. So I think it is different than salt and mineral. I don't know enough about the disease organism to know how long it survives on salt and mineral, but it is, I would say those two are different than liquid scent.
My thinking on it is if we're going to do it, let's do it, and let's not take any chances. I don't know how other members feel. Is anyone particularly attached to salt and minerals? I mean, they're apparently the deer are all over, so you don't really need to bait them. And they're shooting in this zone. And this only applies to this zone, by the way. Skogan?
Mr. Chair, seeing that agriculture is covered further down, I would move that in line 216, we take out liquid scent, salt, and minerals are not feed.
What about just salt and minerals? We heard from DNR that they're...
That's fine. Salt and minerals are not feed.
Just take out salt.
So it would just read liquid scents are not feed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right.
And maybe we can, during this process, we can get more information. And if there's a real passion to put back in salt and minerals, and it's true that it's not a real transmitter, then we can consider adding it back. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be clear and on the record that salt and minerals are not fed on a daily basis. They're placed and they could be there for as long as a month. And so they're not placed on a daily basis.
And that daily basis is just one of the considerations. It can, on line 2.25, the or is, it does, if it said and, I would say that we would need to be concerned, but it says or. So if it's stored consistently, it's covered or placed, I think if it's present solely as a result of normal agriculture practices, as it says on 2.20 and 2.21, I think that covers it.
I'm fine with this, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the Skogan Amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails, the amendment's adopted. Council indicates something about local government issue.
Mr. Chairman, because this does exempt it from rulemaking, it is required by Senate rule to go to the state and local government committee. If you look on lines 2.7 to 2.11, which is a wildlife disease management zone, may be established by written order and that the order is not subject to rulemaking provisions of Chapter 14. So it does seem like it fits in the description of something that's exempting it from rulemaking, the rulemaking process. They currently have, if you look at paragraph C, they currently have the authority for emergency rules adopted under their normal process. And the question is whether they need to have an exempt part of this, or could they do it under their normal emergency rule process?
Mr. Bogus, what are your thoughts on that? Does C suffice?
Mr. Chair, in the interest of expediency, I think we'd like to just remove the exemption from rulemaking to keep this moving, if that's okay with the author.
Mr. Chair, that's right. On page 2, line 9, I think in order to keep this moving along, we would strike that exemption to rulemaking in Chapter 14 and Section 14.386.
All right. So how about the written order to the state register? Does that trigger any local government?
Does that
do it as well?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think what you want to do is remove the two sentences. Delete everything after the period on 2.7. Delete lines 2.8, 2.9, and delete everything before in on 2.10. So you delete those two sentences.
All right. Senator Scogin, would you like to move that? Does everyone understand that? Any further discussion? So the discussion here and the intent is that paragraph C will suffice for the department's rulemaking authority. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Anything else? Any other discussion? Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't here for the entire discussion, but I wanted to know on page 1, line 23, was that $500 civil penalty deleted?
Yep.
Thank you. That needs to be deleted.
Yep. Took that out. It's my understanding that Senator Moore indicated she did not need to see the bill if that penalty was taken out, even though there is a land access issue. She was kind enough to help the bill move along by taking out that penalty. Where is the bill in the House?
Just got introduced.
Mr. Chair, members, as you know, this is a late bill, and I believe, I think Representative Eakin has introduced this in the House.
Okay. It's not scheduled for a hearing yet?
Mr. Chair, I do not know at this point in time.
Okay. Oh, okay. Unless I'm in, I hear, it's my understanding, I'm hearing from staff that it, unless it was introduced today, it has not even yet been introduced in the House. So we need to figure out how we're going to get them going over there.
I think it was introduced today.
It was introduced today?
Well, it was. Yes.
All right. Okay. So then the Sachs-Hogg motion to recommend that Senate File 3811 be recommended as amended to pass.
Recommended to the
pass.
Floor.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much for the hearing, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. This is not a fun topic, but it's just something that has to be done. You know, I was gonna mention before we moved on this that as a member of the Agriculture Committee, we've been talking about this a lot from the agricultural perspective, and I think it's important to note that it's not just the focus is not just on the deer. Current law and other measures are being taken to deal with the agricultural portion of the problem. So, and I've been monitoring that very closely, and my assessment has been that the approach has been balanced, that we've been dealing with the ag, the cattle, the farm survey, and such. But we need to deal with the courier as well as the transmitters. So, okay. If there's no other discussion, the meeting's adjourned.
Do you want to put